What was that?
Oh, yeah. Good. I couldn't get the launch brewing. Oh, that's nice. Thank you. This is great. What a great crowd. Is this great? See, I was going to dress for the fifth chapter, you know. No, I'm serious, you know. I figured they're about the only ones I would, you know. Fuck the rest of them. But it's like, you know, I had nice charcoal gray slacks, blue blazer, you know, Ivy League shirt, which is somewhere on a plane, somewhere. Not here. At least it didn't arrive when I arrived. So this is it. Speaker in traveling clothes. Yeah, well, I wore tennis shoes with my blazer and slack, so I gave up trying to look good. Part of recovery is giving up trying to look good. No, actually, all of recovery is about giving up trying to look good, trying to pretend things are other than they are. I was sitting over there for a minute, and I was thinking, I don't know what made me think it, but I thought, Some lives will be changed tonight. Oh, I was thinking about the dance after. And I was thinking, some lives will be changed tonight. A couple of new relationships will probably start up, and a couple will dissolve. Or at least wither a little, if not die. Somebody's life will change as a result of what I say tonight. At least one person, anyway. And I thought, you know, it's interesting. Life is like that. I mean, that's one of the realities of life that, as an addict, I miss, which is life left alone is constantly changing. And it throws stuff at you all the time. But it seems that people who are heavy into an addiction of any kind, our lives have a tendency to just sort of stay the same. You know? Nothing ever changes a lot. And for those of you who have been clean and sober for a little while, have you noticed you go back and see the old friends? Nothing's changed. You know? The clothes are the same. The dialogue is the same. They're telling the same stories now they were telling 15 goddamn years ago. You know? It's kind of like visiting the family, you know. Nothing changes, you know. The same uncle telling you the same stupid goddamn joke, you know. Probably some racist joke that they've been telling for 20 years or something. You know, it's like nothing changes if you get locked in a thing. And I think that's what throws a lot of us in recovery once we get off the drugs and alcohol, is that one day, I know this happened to me anyway, one day life showed up. I was about 3.5 years clean and sober, and life appeared. I said, "Hi, Bob." And I said, "Oh, my God. I'm not equipped here. I don't know what to do with you, or about you, or for you, or against you. Goodbye. I will go back into some more addictions and recovery, you know. Acceptable ones, work addictions, sex addictions, things that you get, you know, applauded for, you know, love addictions, you know, stuff that's okay because you're no longer sticking a needle in your arm or drinking alcohol, to make me what we will accept, you know, as okay. I have a 26-month-old baby daughter. Yeah, absolutely. Who I just absolutely adore, and it's very hard to leave her to go speak. I don't want to go. You know, it's like she'll be waving, and I just like, oh my God, I don't want to go. But I watch her, and I learn a lot about recovery. And what I learn is about where I'm headed with my recovery. And I realize that one of the things is about children. Is that when I was a kid, you know, I was born with like about 360 degrees of energy. Man, I had energy coming out all sides. And I'm not talking about frenetic, kinetic, hyped up, outer space, laser beam, disco, strobe light kind of energy. You know, that's not the energy I'm talking about.
And I'm talking about that kind of focused energy that's incredibly powerful. And children have it. You ever notice? I mean, they focus on anything, they're there, man. Bang. Now, it may only be for 4 seconds, but it doesn't matter. It is an intense 4 seconds. They're like completely focused on it. And when I originally got here as a little kid, I had all that energy, you know? And it was wonderful, but my energy ran into problems with my parents. So, in order to stop getting killed, back in, you know? So that I could get maybe one hug or some love and not get hit. So I had to start drawing down, getting a little smaller. Not quite so, not so much fun, you know, not so filled with awe and wonder. You ever watch children, they see something new and they just, they're just light up, man, as if they were plugged into something. Just from seeing something. You know, I had all that once upon a time, you know, but it wasn't okay because my parents couldn't deal with it. So I kept stuffing stuff down. And when I hit age 5, I hit the school system. By now, I'm a 5-year-old child of an alcoholic father and the kind of woman who likes that sort of tension in her life, you know, who was married to my alcoholic father, who is also a child batterer. So I've been beaten senseless for about 4 solid years now. And I entered the school system, and my energy's down. I've pulled a lot of it back in to get it out of the way. And I hit the school system, and I got to pull more of it in. You know, I got to get smaller yet, man. I gotta just kind of keep getting down there because there's no place for me in this system. I don't do well in this system. They think I'm not bright in this system. The classic words for most of us are, we don't live up to our potential. You know? Well, guess why? I mean, this idiotic school teacher would put like 2 plus 2 up on the board, and then she'd say to me, Bobby, what's 2 plus 2? Well, I come out of a very high stress home, see? Now, I know what 2 plus 2 is, but I don't know if she knows, okay? Not only do I not know if she knows, I wonder what the consequences are for answering correctly. And I wonder what the consequences are for answering incorrectly. And I wonder, you know, why she picked on me to answer the goddamn question in the first place. And is there a setup here? Is there another two, I don't know about, you know? Well, by the time I'm working all this out in my brain, I'm being labeled as having an attention deficit. And then they call on Susie, who is the class hero, and say, Susie, what's 2 plus 2? And Susie goes, 4. Right? Well, I want to know how to knock Susie off, you know. And she gets the smile from the teacher. And so it's like I begin to become a problem child in school. And they tell my mother, he's a bright kid, but he just can't seem to get it together. Well, that's because every time I turn around at home, somebody's knocking me on my ass, you know. And that will really slow down your attention span, you know. It really absolutely affects how you function in some kind of a controlled environment like that. There's a lot of studies now that say kids that grow up in an alcoholic home have honest-to-God certifiable learning disabilities because of just the tension in the house. I mean, think about going home from school for a minute. I mean, that in and of itself was a wonder, right? I mean, it's like, what's going to be on the other side of the door? I mean, you don't know what's going to be. I don't know if you grew up in my house, you never knew what was going to be on the other side of the door. Were there going to be happy people on the other side of the door? Or were there going to be people waiting to kill me on the other side of the door? You know? And no one would acknowledge anything in my house, so I began to think that I was nuts as a child. I haven't even gotten to drugs and alcohol yet, and I already know I'm crazy. I mean, I'd walk in the house, my parents had probably been having a discussion about killing each other, or me, or something, you know, some kind of... And you walk in the child, and you ever walk in the house as a child, can you remember walking in the house and feeling the tension? I mean, you haven't even seen a parent yet. But it's like there's just bad news in the house. And you walk up to parent, I would, and say, What's wrong?
Nothing's wrong.
All my systems say something's wrong. And yet Mom says nothing's wrong. So I figure if nothing's wrong with her, and nothing's wrong with Dad, and nothing's wrong in the house, then something's wrong with me. Alright? Somehow I'm insufficient. Somehow I'm inadequate. Well, by the time I hit age 12, I'm 6 feet tall. Now we have a problem. I'm still a problem student, but I'm a lot bigger than most of my teachers, and now I'm starting to get an attitude problem. I don't seem to be able to get even with these parents at home, but I seem to be able to do a good job of it at school. So now not only do I have a learning deficit, not only am I slow, not only do I have an attention deficit, now I'm becoming a disciplinary problem. Spending a lot of time in vice principal offices. And then one afternoon, when I was about 14 years old, somebody said, "Smoke this." I watched one of those commercials the government put on, anti-drug commercials, you know, and it showed the brainwave activity of a normal 14-year-old child, you know, which was like that, and it showed the brainwave activity of some kid who's been smoking dope, which was like, and I thought, what idiot put that on the air? You know, I mean, I know thousands of kids will see that and say, "Oh, fuck, that's great, man. Wow." You know, if I could just slow this thing down, God, and get some peace, you know, I'd be all right. Somebody gave me some and it slowed it down. It slowed it down. I wasn't suddenly 100 miles out there trying to figure out the consequences of every move I made.
Will this happen? Will that happen? Will she talk to me? Will he not talk to me if I answer? If I walk here with him? You know, I mean, it's like...
Just walking down the hall of school, man, was an exercise in psychosis. You know, that was amazing, you know. And paranoia. And so, this little tiny cigarette quieted all that down. Whoa, isn't this nice?
No paranoia. That wasn't going to last long, but
no paranoia, just kind of mellow. And if people wonder why we go to the lengths we go to get this stuff, you know. I've heard people say in Alcoholics Anonymous, "I am an alcoholic because I drink too much." Okay. I don't have an argument with that, because I don't know the guy and I didn't follow him around. I have no idea. But I know I had lots of problems. Lots of problems. Long before I ever encountered the first chemical. The chemicals became an answer to a lot of my problems. Man, I was coming apart at the seams, and then first came grass, and it just sort of slowed me down, quieted the mind a little bit. And somebody gave me a little red wine to go with the grass. And I started to feel not so inadequate. Not so insufficient. And then somebody saw I starting to get sleepy behind this red wine and this grass. So they gave me some methamphetamine to put in my veins. Suddenly I felt quiet mind, not so insufficient, not so inadequate. And it was the energy to go for a year. So, this is a hell of a lot better than I felt at 5 years old, first day of school, you know? I'm like up now. This is much better, much better. I'm now suddenly got some of my energy back. I now have even a little bit of the awe and wonder back that I had as a child. I get behind a little grass. I hear a little music. I go, wow. That's good. You know, I didn't like music, you know, but it's like, oh. So these chemicals, initially, when I first encountered them, I started to feel okay. I started to get back some of that magic that I had when I was a child. Well, unfortunately, there's a small problem apparently attached to chemical addiction. Eventually, they turn on you. Now, granted, some of us have a tendency to abuse them. You know, it's like, yeah, well, you know, when you got the turkey baster cranked up with about 6.5 cc's of morphine to see whether or not you will die or live, if you back it with a little methamphetamine, you are, in fact, abusing the chemicals and your body. And eventually, it seems like, at first I started to feel okay, then I started to just leave the planet, you know, just gone. Then the combinations of chemicals that I kept trying to feel okay with were destroying the brain cells, so I was getting really strange. Then I felt worse than I felt before I started the chemicals, but I also felt more hopeless than I felt before I started taking the chemicals, because now there was nothing I could do about it. Because every time I would try and give up the chemicals, the need inside of me was like some monster that needed to be fed, you know, like that plant in the little shop of horrors, you know. Feed me, you know. So a large portion of society paid because I had to feed him, you know, something. Well, when I cranked up to my 26th birthday, I wasn't doing well. I weighed about 135 pounds. I weigh about 195 now, if you can imagine. Just take that down, and I don't look good at 135. This was pretty destroyed by then. I was a derelict, more or less, living in doorways. Through a strange set of circumstances called Eskimos, I wound up in an AA meeting 27 years ago. Wow, you know, I've been clean and sober over half my life. Over half my life, I've been clean and sober. So, they stick me in the AA meeting, then I have a reaction to my initial meetings that a lot of people have. Some people love it and feel right at home, and other people, we don't like it at all, but we got no place else to go. You know, we don't like the people. I got sober in Pasadena, you know, and I looked at the room and it was full of marks, you know, and I said, oh God, you know, is this going to be fun here, you know. There was no place else to go. No place else to go. I mean, I'm not still here because I'm an honorable person. I'm still here because there was no place else to go, you know. It was really very simple. And eventually I got some sponsorship. And now, today, in light of all the information that I have amassed in 27 years, right, if I look at my sponsorship, it was really abusive. You know, it was terrible. Fuck you. Sit down. Shut up. Listen. Don't talk for 90 goddamn days, asshole. You don't know anything, you dumb freak. They're saying this while they're standing under the sign that says, we care. You know, that's what the fact is, right? You know? But it was okay, see? It was familiar. It was sort of like being home with the family again, you know? Like being a little kid, you know, just you're dumb, you're stupid, you don't know, sit down, don't talk, be quiet, go here, sit there, move this, wash that, make this, you know. I'm out of the generation of coffee makers that gave hours of thought and fantasy to poisoning the group, you know. Like, constantly thinking about putting some Raid in the coffee or something, you know, just to show the bastards it wasn't okay, you know, it really wasn't okay.
years later, looking back with all the information I have, I wouldn't change it. Wouldn't change it. Not for me. It worked. I'm still here. I was comfortable with it. And after these guys beat me up a little bit, you know, abused me a little bit, they showed me what the coffee shops were, where you go afterwards to have coffee and talk to the people. And they showed me where other meetings were. I didn't have a car, you know, drove me around. They gave me phone numbers, so I had people to call to talk to. Got about a year on the program. They got me involved in institutional work all over the goddamn state. A lot of stuff I didn't want to do. Didn't have any place else to go. Okay? Well, now, a year sober, I get my own car. Now I know where the coffee shops are. I know where the meetings are. I got a phone, so now I start getting somebody. You know, I take him and yell and scream at him and abuse him. You know, and it feels good, you know? Felt all right, you know? It's like, oh, retribution here, you know? If I wasn't getting laid, all my babies were celibate, you know? It's like... All right, guys, you want spiritual health here? I'll tell you how to achieve it. Listen, you know, therapists, when therapists first start out, they practice too. So, you know, sponsors in AA practice, psychologists practice. When they walk out of school the first day, all they got's classroom, pal, for the most part. You know, it's all we learn off each other. It's okay. It's not bad. So I have beat a few people up. You know, what the hell? Most of them are still here. Some of them died. But, you know, I don't think that I had a lot to do with one way or the other. You know, I don't think we have all the power we think we have. So... then I start to move into sobriety, you know. Now, God, I got babies and I got a car and I know where the coffee shops are and I know where the meetings are and I got a phone number and people call me all the time and get advice from me. I don't know anything, but they're calling all the time, you know. And I got answers. I mean, I got answers. I mean, that's answers and opinions, Christ. I'm not no shortage of those, and I would give them out, you know, readily, you know. Advising people in their life, well, I don't think you should do this for a year, right? Well, geez, you know. And people always are saying, you know, oh, no, God, don't get emotionally involved in the first year, you know. That's not written anywhere. You know, it's not written anywhere. I know a couple of people are going to approach the dance now with renewed enthusiasm. Bob Earl said it was okay, honey. I think it's saved a lot more lives than it's taken, I'll tell you. I'm one, you know, I was involved 3 weeks clean sober. Saved my life. Saved my life. This poor girl was so fragile, man, she believed everything everybody was telling her in AA, including the guy that took her out to the car to tell her that most of her drinking problems stemmed from her sexual frustration, and he was going to help her with it, right? Right? She went for it. You know, she went for it. Well, I was the opposite. I didn't believe nobody and didn't like anybody. So we were a lovely match. We saved each other's lives. We really saved each other's lives. It was wonderful. Without each other, I don't think either one of us would still be here. You know? So there's a lot of that in there. There's a lot of rules made up by people who... Oh, never mind.
The Antichrist is here, you know.
I think controversy is good for AA, goddammit, needs a little, you know?
Wake up and smell the cow manure, you know, and
so now I know where the coffee shops are, I know where the meetings are, I'm sponsoring guys, I got my car, I'm running around town, and I am crazier than a loon. And each day of sobriety, I'm not getting better, I'm getting worse. See? And I never, ever...
Oh, thank you, but no. I don't know what it is, but if it's colored, I don't drink it. Water would be nice, however. You could just rinse the ice cubes off and just sink or something.
Well, things change. I used to drink 18, 24 cans of tab a day. So, you know, this is... That, well, I used to enjoy it a lot. I know how to abuse myself sober. I didn't stop with giving up the drugs and alcohol. And just for most of us, by the way. So anyway, I started getting crazier, but there was nobody to talk to about it. I had run into a terrible problem in recovery. Everybody else was okay. You know, and that was killing me. And if you ask them how they were, they'd say, fine. And that was like it. Fine. How are you, Bob? I'm fine. Thank you very much. And then you find out all these terrible things that just happened to them. You know, their wife died, their child was hit by a car, they lost their job. And you say, how are you? Fine. I'm fine. Thanks. So the message I got was synonymous or compatible. It was compatible with the message I got when I was a child. Even when things aren't okay, pretend. Pretend they are okay, because you'll get along better if you pretend things are all right. Well, I started to have some strange fantasies about this time, right? Not the ones that came up during meditation. I'm talking about the other ones, okay? And everybody's always still going, and nobody talks about the truth, right?
People say, well, Bob, you have a problem like that. I go home and meditate.
Yeah, and this is the middle of the day, you know. Go home and meditate, Bob. You'll feel better. I never can remember a time, the first 5 years at least I was sober, that afternoon meditation wasn't either sexual fantasy, excessive masturbation, or a nap. You know? Did you meditate, Bob? Oh, yes. I feel better. Thank you. Thank you very much. Appreciate that. Because they wanted me to talk to God, and I said, who's God? They said, turn it over. I said, oh, to who? I like that idea. Do you like that concept? Turn it over? That's a hell of a concept. I have been looking for somebody for a long time to give it all to. Turn it over. Okay, I will. To whom? Well, to God. Who's God? Oh, he's your father. Bad image. You know? A lot of talk about society about imaging today. That is not a good one, okay? So I didn't want anything to do with this guy. So anyway, I'm going through all this crap. I'm getting crazier with each day of my recovery. But there's no one to talk to. So the only way I can stop the pain is one of two things. Compulsive thinking, live here, regardless of what's going on, live here. And usually it was really terrible, you know.
You're a jerk, you're stupid, you'll never amount to anything, you're going to die by the time you're 30 fucking years old. You're going to drink tonight, you know, you're going to be in the podium and fart the next time you do an interview talk. And you're like,
this is like, yeah, but that living here was more acceptable than living here. Because it hurt in here. Real bad. But I didn't know quite what it was or what to do about it. So I would constantly be driving down the freeway in Los Angeles, and there would be a car in front of me, and my fantasy would be that this car would lose control and spin out and roll end over end, smash into one of the concrete abutments and burst into flames. And there'd be like a family in the car, a husband and a wife and like four kids. And I'd be able to get the wife out of this burning car and two of the children, but then the fire would be too intense and I would be unable to save the father and the other two children. And then there I'd be on 6 o'clock news, you know, standing there with my arms all bandaged from terrible burns and my face burned, my eyebrows gone, my hair is singed, covered black, you know, and just saying, well, you know, I just did what anybody else would do, you know, in similar circumstances. I would be driving to an AA meeting to be the speaker to tell you how to live your life with this fantasy, you know, about this car crashing. Or I'd be on a plane and it would be that the plane would crash. And I'd be crawling through the smoke and flame over the bodies in the plane, looking for the people that were alive and helping them get to the door and out the slide and down to safety. And there I'd be again, you know, on the 6 o'clock news, my arms all wrapped with horrible burns, my eyebrows gone, my face black with soot, most of my hair gone, saying, well, you know, I did what anybody would do. And it wasn't until maybe 6 years ago I finally got in touch with what the hell that was all about.
And all that was all about was I was crying out desperately for some external manifestation of my inner pain. I wanted you to see on the outside how bad I hurt. And so being burned to me, which is the worst pain that you can have, it was like being burned. If I could just get burned, and I have been burned, then you'll know that I really hurt awfully bad. And if I've saved some people's lives in the process of getting burned, then you'll know that I'm a good guy. I'm really a good guy with a good heart, but I just hurt real bad. But I couldn't say that to anybody. So when somebody would say, you, me, Bob, how are you? I said, I'm fine, thanks. Fine. And then I'd leave the meeting and get in my car and drive down the freeway and have the fantasy one more time. If I could just do this, if I could just get burned, people would know how bad I really hurt. In the interim, you know, I'm laughing and bopping and being cute and telling AA jokes and going to the meetings and sponsoring guys and, you know, on down the road I go. But the rest of my life I'm having problems with relationships, not doing too well. Employment, serious difficulties, employment. Money management, major problem with money management. So on one side, my life is going down, and any time pain comes up, I've got a dozen other addictions going, right? How do you feel, Bob? Great, got cigarettes going, caffeine, I mean, I'm wired on caffeine, drinking 30 cups a day, you know. I'm okay, feel pretty good. The stuff doesn't bother me much. Life's rolling. You know. Okay, I took a couple of guys one time who lived their entire lives in a spiritual environment, took them to some AA meetings, and came out of that and said, just which addiction have these people given up? I said the big one. We'll get to the others later. Okay, so, now I march forward in sobriety one crisis after the other. 5 years in, I surrender to God. Totally, completely, absolutely. I'm so crazy. I want to die worse than I ever want to die in my life. I never contemplated suicide one time drinking and using. And from the probably 2.5 years of sobriety to 5 years of sobriety, it became a constant thought. I would wake up in the morning and suicide was like the alternative to the day.
What are you going to do about today, Bob? I'm going to kill myself. That's the only way to do about today. That's the only possible solution I can think of to today.
And that's kind of how it went, right? So finally, with that kind of total pain and insanity, I screamed at God, oh, please, God, to help me. And I wind up breaking my back and becoming a television writer. Not bad. Great career. Lots of money. Lots of praise. Bouncing along with the television writers. Still a few small problems, though. I feel insufficient. I feel inadequate. I feel like there's something wrong with me. Somewhere down deep, there's something wrong with me. Compulsive thinking is out of control.
This will be your last script. You'll never write another script as long as you live. And then what are you going to do? You still don't have any goddamn education. You've wasted the last 5 years of your fucking life. You're screwed. You know that? And you're going to be old and poor. You're not going to have anywhere to go. By the time you're old, Social Security is going to be in the toilet. So what are you going to do then, you dumb son of a bitch? Go get a job, you know.
Well, that was my family talking to me. You know, because every time I would call my mother, she'd say, oh, what show have you written lately? So I can tell the relatives.
I say, oh, gee, Mom, I've had a bad 2 or 3 months here. I haven't written anything. Or maybe you should go back to being a diecaster. Go get a job. Why? Well, she couldn't understand anything about anything creative. Getting a job is all she knew.
but I'm doing that to me, and I'm bounding down the road, and I'm still driving down freeways, and I'm still having fantasies about being all burned up so somebody knows how bad I hurt. Forget the fact that I've got my name on my parking spot and my office and secretaries, and I'm working on hit television shows and all that shit. Doesn't change a thing, man. I'd be driving a new Cadillac down the freeway, going into the studio in the morning, picturing the car in front of me, rolling over and over and crashing in the bowl and bursting into flames, you know. The only difference would be it would stay underneath my picture on the 6 o'clock news television lighter, and I like that. That was better, you know. Like, I am somebody, you know. Because I don't have anything going on inside of me. There's nothing goddamn going on inside of me except pain. And I don't know who to talk to about the pain because nobody's talking about pain. Everybody's goddamn okay. And I'm sick of people being okay. And I'd go to men's stays and they were so full of shit I wanted to die, you know. Everybody in there is out of the...
pull yourself up by the bootstraps mentality, goddammit. You know, yeah, well, my old man beat the shit out of me, but I had it coming. You understand? It's okay. I was a rotten little bastard, and it's got nothing to do with my life today. And yeah, I just lost my job, but so what? I'll own the company next year, and if you had any balls, son, you'd stop sniveling, you know.
And we all, after the men's stag, y'all go to the men's room, get out the ruler, you know, Jesus.
Spiritual growth at its optimum level. It's a different talk than I've given in a while. I'm enjoying it a lot.
In the 17 years of sobriety, I live in a penthouse apartment at the beach, a big, beautiful two-bedroom penthouse. I got a gorgeous knockout girlfriend. I'm divorcing a gorgeous, expensive wife, killing me to divorce. I don't care. Driving a very new, expensive car, roller skating on the boardwalk in Venice, the hit television show, a whole goddamn thing. I mean, I'm at the top, man. All the success I ever even never dreamed I would ever have in my wildest fantasy, and I still driving down the freeway, and I'm still seeing the car roll over in front of me, and I'm still standing on the 6 o'clock news, burned badly. I just want some one goddamn person to understand I hurt. I don't know why I hurt. I just know I hurt, and I know that I've hurt for a long time, and I just want something out here that you can see so you understand how bad I hurt. And I would wake up in the morning, and suicide has long since been an alternative, and all I wanted to do was lay down and die, man. I just wanted to get out of bed, lay down on the floor next to the bed, and die. And I would have been very happy. But if you looked at the outsides, they were tremendous money coming in the wheelbarrows. What people weren't paying any attention to is I was putting it out in wheelbarrows, too. You know, I had no responsibility. I didn't know how to take care of myself. I didn't care enough about myself to do anything that had any sense attached to it at all, because I never learned these lessons from my parents. Finally, somebody said to me, in fact, the girl I was in a relationship with said, look, you've been married 5 times. Maybe it wasn't them. As much as I'm embarrassed to admit it, that never entered my mind. Never crossed my mind that it wasn't them. I mean, it's like, you know, I was just having a run of picking the wrong door, you know? When I got door 1, 2, or 3, I just kept going for the wrong goddamn door. So I thought, okay, maybe you're right, and I want to die anyway, so I went to see a therapist. Now, as a solid,
well-meaning member of AA, a staunch member of AA, a good sponsor, I had always been very supportive of guys I sponsored who went to get their therapy for help. They would come to me and say, geez, you know, I'm going to have to go see somebody because I'm, you know, I've done all this the best I can. I don't feel good, you know. I want to die a lot. I'd say to them, in my arrogance, well, obviously AA and I aren't enough. So I suggest you find another sponsor.
What I was telling him was the truth, of course, obviously. AA and I wasn't enough, right? You know, and they did need something else, right? I didn't understand the truth of my words, what I was saying. And I'd fire them, make them go get another sponsor. Then here I am, 17 years, man, and I got to go. You know, and I picked a woman for a therapist because I figured, okay, that's my problem. You know, relationships. I get some inside information here. So my first encounter with this woman, she said, tell me about yourself. Start with your childhood. I said, well, you know, when I was 15 years old, I started using drugs, alcohol. They threw me out of school and I'm manual arts. And, you know, 17 years ago, I walked into AA and NA, and I've been clean and sober ever since. She said, I should start with your childhood. You weren't born at 15. I said, I don't remember anything before 15. She looked at me and she smiled a very strange smile. I thought it was a self-serving smile, you know. I thought it was, oh boy, call the Rolls dealer and tell him I'll take the leather interior, you know. this sucker's going to pay for all of it, you know. And not having any sense of anything about healing or emotional pain, her smile was saying to me, if you've got the courage to stick it out with me, I'm going to be present when you meet yourself. And the thought of that brought a smile to her face. Well, geez, I had the courage and we stuck it out, and one day, by God, I met me. And I discovered a lot of really interesting things about me. The first major number one thing I discovered was I wasn't my fault. I wasn't my fault. That the line that people were shoving down my throat, your mother and father did the best job they could with tools they had, was true. It was absolutely true. They did. What wasn't being said was, by the way, or not said, acknowledged, was the job they did was fucking horrible. You know? It was criminally punishable in a court of law. My mother should have been taken to jail. I was 2 years old and she was beating me with her fists. I didn't do anything to deserve that. She was so afraid of my father, she couldn't buy me shoes that fit. So I have my right foot's practically a club foot, and I have lots of trouble with my feet. Wear special inserts in my shoes. That's why I gave up bullshit pretense. Now I wear tennis shoes with everything, you know? I stopped wearing expensive loafers, you know, like I'm okay, you know? Then go to an AA meeting, give a talk, and limp out, you know? But I look good for a minute, right? That's what it's about. I had a hot minute. And in this process with this woman, she allowed me to go back and tell her how bad I hurt and how terrible the pain was. And she led me back there and let me feel all this stuff. And suddenly I found my energy coming back. And suddenly I found out when I looked in a mirror, I even sort of had a little compassion for the guy. That horse shit about looking in the mirror when you're new and say, I love you. Have you done that? I would stand there and sneer. You know? And finally I'd walk away from the mirror saying, oh, you are the sickest son of a bitch. And I'd look in a window and I'd see my reflection and I'd smile a little bit. I'd go, wow. He's okay. This guy's okay. So I hung in there and I hammered along with this stuff. And I suddenly became convinced that the issues that I drank and used over were the issues of what happened when I was a kid. You know? That when they talk in the big book about the bottles is but a symptom of, it is that crap that it is what it's a symptom of, man. I hurt bad before I ever started using drugs and alcohol. I was in emotional trouble before I ever discovered the stuff. I felt insufficient, inadequate. I was wall-to-wall shame before I ever picked up the first joint, took the first drink, you know, did anything else. I was a walking mess. And I had nothing to do with it. It was done to me.
Now, suddenly I felt a little better. And then it was explained to me, however they did it to you, Bob, they can't fix it. They can't fix 1 second of it. You have to fix it. I said, hey, you know what? That's okay. I like that. I feel more hopeful now that I know I didn't deserve it. Now that I know that it's wrong. And suddenly my whole life began to open up a little bit. And I started to take a little better care of myself. And suddenly I'm not smoking. And I'm not drinking 24 cans of tab a day. And I'm not drinking 32 cups of coffee. And I'm not eating sugar. I'm knocking off red meat. And I'm knocking off this and that. And I begin to sort of participate in life. And I start to understand that life is strange and wonderful and has this weird rhythm to it, up and down. Some days are great, some days are down. And I realize, God, one of the lies they told me when I first got sober was, everything's going to be okay.
No, it's not. Oh, no, it's not. Not even goddamn close, let me tell you, Roy.
But the difference is, today, even though things aren't okay in my life, right now I'm living in a town I don't like, I hate. The house is for sale. If anybody would like a nice house in Arizona, they'll see me after. I mean, that's a lot of things wrong. We had a lot of people die the first of last year. My mom, my wife's dad, a 20-year-old stepdaughter of mine was found dead in an alley from an overdose of drugs. I mean, we had a lot of pain and a lot of grief and a lot of sadness, and things were anything but okay. Anything but. The difference is, I'm okay. I'm okay. Things aren't great, but I'm all right. But I'm okay. Spirits are pretty good. Feel okay most of the time. Have some real down days. Have some terrible moments. Get angry at times at where I live and what I perceive the consciousness of the people to be where I live. I call it into question on many issues. From wife abuse to child abuse to alcoholism, drug addiction, the environment, just a few other issues. Other than that, they're doing okay.
So, what are you saying, Bob? Sum all this up. Get to the point.
The point is that recovery seems, for me, based on my experience and experience of friends of mine, it comes in phases. That is a definitely progression to recovery, which is probably why they said, you know, spiritual progress meaning something's always changing, because in order for things to progress, things must always be changing, which means then people are moving on down the road, learning new things, letting new information in, throwing out what they don't like, taking what's new, not throwing away the person that brings the goddamn information, just throwing out the information, okay, you know? It's like suddenly I'm not so threatened by new information, and it's okay that somebody else has found a way to do it that's different than mine. I can remember when I first got clean and sober, some of my old crime partners cleaned up through Team Challenge, which is a rigid fundamentalist Christian organization. And I couldn't even go to one of their meetings, man, the first year and a half, because I thought if their thing worked, it meant mine wouldn't. Because my whole thinking coming out of the kind of home I is black and white. There's only room for one of anything. One opinion, one program that works, one God, one anything. There's not room for any other concepts because they're terrifying people who live in this controlled, rigid little environment. Well, now, man, you know, I can go. Well, finally, I went to their thing and I thought, wow, these guys are okay. I mean, they're okay. They're off goddamn drugs. Well, I remember this sick son of a bitch. You know, it's like, he's standing up. I've never seen him standing up. You know, I've never seen the man upright. And he's smiling and he's happy and he's doing his thing. So I learned that it's okay to get information. You know, there's a thing about it. See, it's like the big book says, God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Okay, I think he's disclosed a lot over the last 50 years. But it seems that we have a little trouble letting the information in. You know, it's like
Test your home group. Next time you're in your home group, say, tonight I'd like the topic to be nutrition. And see how well that's received. Well, let me tell you something interesting about nutrition. They've done lots of research all over this country in all kinds of laboratories and stuff. And if you were to put up a list over here of all the accepted symptoms, identified, recognized, accepted symptoms of low blood sugar on this side, and if you put up all the accepted symptoms identified and recognized of a dry drunk on this side, they would be identical. Identical. Goddamn identical. Well, if they're identical, then am I missing something here? Should we be talking about this stuff? You know what I'm saying? I mean, if you're eating sugar and in the middle of the night and you wake up in the morning, you want to die, maybe, you might want to make the connection, That 2.5 quarts of pralines and cream with a family-sized bag of Oreos is somehow damaging your emotional well-being, And then if you want to feel better in the morning, I have to get an individual-sized bag of Oreos. To withdraw, to get down to where I'll be okay. You see, so one of the things where I get upset sometimes, and a lot of people get upset with me because I talk about ACA. I think it's great. I think we needed adult children of alcoholics so goddamn desperately, Because there's a lot of stuff we need to talk about. We got to stop pretending that none of this shit happened. And walk around like, I'm okay. My father raped me 42 times, when I was a child, but I'm really okay. I'll be fine. No, bullshit. You're not going to be okay. And you're not going to be okay until you talk about it and you cry about it and you scream about it and you die behind it and you feel the worst pain you ever felt in your life and you walk out the other side of it. Well, yes, folks. But I'm not sure an AA meeting is a place to do that. And I'll tell you why. I think there's a very good reason for that. You might have some girl in terrible, horrible pain over having been incested by a drunken father. And you might have at that meeting a guy 3 days sober who incested a daughter 20 years ago, and seeing the girl's pain, the reality that might be just a little more at meeting three that's okay for this guy to handle. So if that's the case, then this girl needs some place to take that. So where I get into an argument with people in the program is, don't you even start to fucking think you can tell me about where I can go, or where I can pick up the tools I need to survive. You see, if I need to go to ACA to get rid of my pain, get out of my way. You do not have the right. No one made you goddamn God to get in my way and stop me from doing my healing. If you don't need the tools... If you don't need the tools I need, it just means you and I are different. It doesn't mean there's anything wrong with me, and it doesn't mean there's anything wrong with you. The big book and the 12 steps may be all you need for the next 50 years of your life. Great! I almost died. I needed to get additional stuff. We're both okay. I don't want you to stop reading the big book. I don't want you to stop working the steps. I don't want you to stop going to meetings. And I don't want you to get in the way of the stuff I'm doing. I don't want you to bother me when I'm going to a CODA meeting or an ACA meeting or when I'm studying about dysfunctional families or when I'm conducting workshops. Get the hell out of my way! You don't like the information? Jesus, that's okay! Where did we get the idea that we all got to agree? You ever go... Think about your meeting you go to. It's like everybody's got to agree. And one person disagrees, the whole group hammers them into agreeing. So you can't like have a different opinion. Well, that's in the world of function and dysfunction is highly dysfunctional. Functional human beings, of which I'm just starting to meet some now that I'm becoming one. I realize they don't hang out with us. Well, there's a couple of reasons for that. One is we scare them to death, you know, because they operate off feelings. So when we're standing there telling them we're okay, they know better. So they perceive that there's something really wrong if you can't tell them something's wrong. And they bore us to tears. You know, so it's like, there's not a compatible relationship for a while. But you can put a half a dozen functional people in a room and each one can have an entirely differing opinion about the same subject. And no one has to be wrong. No one has to be wrong. I learned about being wrong when I was a child. There was only room for one opinion in the house. I learned that if I had information you didn't have, I was superior to you. I also learned the reverse of that. They didn't teach me that, but you learn it quick. If you have information I don't have, then you're superior to me. It doesn't mean that you read a different book than me. I mean, it just negates me completely as a human being. It wipes me off the earth. So, if you find yourself in your 12-step recovery running into a wall of pain, tell somebody about it. And if you don't get what you perceive to be an adequate response, tell somebody else about it. You know? Because to not talk to people is to be caught right up in the rules of an alcoholic family, which is isolation, secrecy, and denial. I mean, those are the rules most of us grew up with.
Don't invite anybody in because you don't want them to know what the hell's going on in the house. Secrets are mandatory. You know, deny everything. Yeah. Geez, Bob, you think you have a smoking problem? You know, my fingers are yellow, you know, my hair is yellow, my face is yellow. No. It's okay, you know.
I thought denial went away at your first meeting. Right? I don't drink and use anymore. Obviously, denial is no longer part of my life. Denial, apparently, is part of our lives for a long time until we become willing to break through it. What's the difference between now and 10 years ago?
Well, father, that's nice, that's lovely. The difference is that I have a consciousness today about myself and about the world in which I live. I get letters sometimes from people because I do a lot of talks professionally, and when I'm in a city doing a talk professionally, we'll also do usually I try and do a fundraiser. And I got a letter recently from some guy saying that I was destroying AA because I was giving a talk for this organization in Monterey County, and that they would, of course, assume because of my membership in AA that AA somehow approved this organization. And it, with people like me out there doing that stuff, AA was, you know, destined to die. Those letters always hurt me for a couple of reasons, you know. But the other thing with humorous about this is the talk I was giving was a fundraiser for the Monterey County AIDS Project. The other thing that's humorous about all this crap is I never say that I'm a member of AA. Never mention it. Never comes up in my talk. I respect the traditions probably as much as anybody else I know, including these guys who are running around screaming them at every goddamn meeting. You know, we just have different ways to do it. But what has happened to me is that I'm waking up. I got a consciousness about a lot of things that are wrong in my society. It's 1990 and women still aren't safe in their home. Something's fucking wrong. Something's wrong. You know, it's like, I read statistics last year that said the number one cause of death in infants under 1 year of age was homicide. Homicide. Children are being beaten every goddamn minute because people are crazy, man. They're frustrated and they hurt and they're sad and they're sick and they're broke and they're tired and they live in a society that basically doesn't give a shit about them. I mean, that's the truth. Whether you want to look at it or not. So I'm starting to see some of this stuff and I'm starting to get angry about it. It's not okay anymore. I'm not just walking around. How are you, Bob? I'm fine. I'm not fine. I'm really pissed off. Really pissed off. But the difference is today I do something about it. I either get a whole room pissed off with me, right? You know. Or I write a letter, or I call
somebody, or I do something, or I make a statement about it when I get a chance on television or on radio. I do something, or I sat down about a year ago and wrote my book. Man, I said, God, I owe this to myself. To talk about the pain of recovery once the alcoholism and drugs is over. And I said, yeah, and it was a great gift to myself, my book, and I'm glad I wrote it. And I can get information out there. So the difference is, man, I'm all right today, and I look around, and I don't have to make excuses for people anymore about stuff that's going on. And I can look and say, things need to be changed. And I want to be part of the change. And about a year ago, I came out of the bathroom with tears streaming down my face, and my wife said to me, you know, this is our little motion, you know, we do it to each other, which is, you know, I think you need to talk. And I said, I've just been in there trying to figure out what I'm going to do with the rest of my life. And she said, what did you decide? I said, between now and the day I die, I would like to do what I can to make the world a safer place for children. That's what I'd like to do. And what's brought that about is I've learned to care about me, and in learning to care about me, I've learned to care about you. You know? It's that simple. It's that simple. And but the tragedy for most of us is this one, and it's interesting. A woman I know who I respect a lot, a psychologist, said, the problem with the adults who grew up in dysfunctional families, particularly the alcoholic family, our tendency is to seek out familiar pain. We seek familiar pain. We keep going to the pain we know. We keep going to the pain we understand. We keep creating the circumstances and things that we understand. If you're the kind that builds everything up almost okay and then destroys it, whatever it is, we seek the familiar pain. And the tragedy of that is that our healing, our real healing, lies in the unknown pain. It lies in that pain that we're so afraid to walk through. But I tell you, there's a lot of stuff today if you've got pain. There's good therapists. There's ACA. There's AA, man. The steps will work. I mean, it says in the exact nature of our wrongs. I think it's time to stop here. All right, I'll cover the exact nature. And then, like I would go to my, I'll do this real fast because I've told the story before, but I think it's important. I would go to one of my sponsors and I'd say, I backed my wife's car into a pole today at the shopping mall and I lied to her about it and told her somebody hit it while it was parked. And they'd say, Bob, you're in recovery now. And there's no room for lying in recovery. So I would be appropriately shamed and I would go, okay, I won't do that again. And I take my inventory and I go home. A year later, I'd be back. New inventory, new sponsor, new wife. I grew up in a home where you replace things, you know. Same story. I backed my wife's new car into a pole, dented it, lied to her, told her somebody else hit it, and they would say the same thing. Bob, you're in recovery now. There's no place for lying. I know that, for Christ's sake. I know that. Don't tell me there's no place for lying, you ass. I understand that. Help me get to whatever it is that's going on. See, somebody who understood would say, geez, why did you lie to her, Bob? To which I would reply, I don't know. Well, you must have had a reason. Well, I don't know. I don't know. If I told her the truth, she'd get mad. Yeah, she might. Yeah, it would be okay to get angry appropriately over having a new car backed into a pole. Well, I don't like it when she's mad. Well, why don't you like it when she's mad? When she gets mad, I want to kill her. Bob, do you think that wanting to take your wife's life over some appropriate anger is an overreaction? And if there's something underneath that we need to find? I don't know.
killer, Bob. I mean, this would not happen as fast as I'm giving it to you. It might take 3 months, you know, or 6 months. I want to kill her, goddammit, because I'm scared to death when she gets mad. And then we would say, well, Bob, she's 5 feet two, she weighs 105 pounds. You're 6 feet tall, you weigh 195 pounds. I don't think she can physically hurt you. What are you afraid of? And we would keep digging and we would keep looking and we would get back till eventually I would remember being beaten senseless with my mother's fists. And then we would understand why I was so afraid when women would get angry. I didn't care when men got angry. It didn't bother me. I'm a psychopath, Corey, in the shrinks in the state of California. But you let a woman get mad and I would do anything to make it okay. Anything to stop them because I was petrified. Because inside of me was this little tiny guy who had been hit so hard, so often, and hurt so bad. And the minute a woman would get angry in front of him, he just wanted to die. Well, that's the exact nature, man, of the lie. That's where you gotta go, I'm convinced, if you're gonna heal. The exact nature is I was beaten senseless and I am terrified of the anger of women. It's the exact nature of the wrong. That's where the healing lays, in the exact natures. So I want to wish you well in looking for the exact nature. And what is it Bill and Ted says? Party on, dudes. God bless you.